This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Join us today for stories about the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. In this week's show, oil in the Niger Delta. The companies may be profiting, but the locals aren't.
The truth is, a lot of the money just gets stuck right there in the hands of the government.
Plus, fighting a culture of abandonment, part two in our series on Romania's neglected children, and walking for water in Ethiopia.
People break their bones, they dislocate their joints. And the problem is worse when we go to fetch water when it is dark. One woman fell down while she was pregnant and she lost the baby.
All that and more coming up on the World Vision Report. Decades ago, parents in Romania who couldn't afford to care for their babies were encouraged to send them to state-run orphanages. More than 100,000 babies were warehoused in Romanian orphanages in the 1980s. Today, impoverished Romanians still abandon their babies, thousands of them each year. But the old orphanages are gone, and a troubling new trend is flourishing. In part two of our series on abandoned Romanian babies, we take a look at what happens when mothers walk away. Sarah Birchtold raises and latches the metal gate as she gently places one more baby back in her crib.
I hate the sound of these bits. It sounds like you're shutting a prison door.
Sarah is a volunteer at a local hospital in the city of Brașov. Like many hospitals throughout Romania, this one is filled with children who were abandoned by their mothers at birth. We saw at least 30 abandoned babies during our visit here, many of them old enough to crawl.
It's okay. It's okay. When did she come into the hospital? This is the one that the police officer came 2 days ago. He was sent out to find her mother. And I guess, obviously, she's not going home, so that he hasn't found her. Hey, Lumita, it's okay.
How old is she?
About 8 months. I've known this little girl for a while.
The room right next door is filled with four more abandoned children. One of them, with large brown eyes and a tussle of dark brown curly hair, grins at us as he stands in his crib, holding onto the rails.
This is Marius, and he lived his life in this hospital. He's basically spent his first year in the hospital. Basically, these cribs are like little holding tanks.
A child Marius's age should be taking his first steps by now, but he can only stand.
What are you guys doing? How many
kids are down here? Sarah heads up a small team of volunteers who feed, diaper, and rock these babies.
So basically we're kind of dealing with the children that are left, so they're not laying in their cribs 24 hours a day and that they're not regressing, but that we can just give them love, we can exercise them, we can help them start to walk so that they're not rotting in their cribs.
According to UNICEF, more than 4,000 babies are abandoned at birth in Romania each year. That's 1% of all newborns. Under Romanian law, the infants must be placed into foster care within a week of their birth. But in reality, hospitals have become the new orphanages. Pierre Pupard is head of UNICEF in Romania. He says the problem is not due to a shortage of foster parents.
Foster families, they can train new people because it's a kind of attractive job in this country. Because people can earn 200, 250 euros per month for having a child in foster. So it's not a problem of people. No, there's no money for paying those people. The budget is not enough.
But the Romanian Secretary of State for Adoption says that's nonsense. In fact, Theodora Bertzi told us the foster care system in Romania is running well.
Are you saying there should be no children left in the hospitals who've been abandoned?
Deci dumneavoastră spuneți că n-ar trebui să existe copii abandonați în maternitate. Healthy children, no, for sure.
Copiii în acea maternitate înseamnă că asistenții sociali care trebuie să lucreze nu au lucrat suficient de bine.
And if there are still children there in the maternity, that means that the social workers working there in the maternity didn't do their job.
Blaming social workers for letting babies languish in hospital wards doesn't go over too well with Gabby, who asked that we not use her last name. She's a social worker who works full-time hunting down the parents of abandoned children.
If she won't take the baby, what can I do?
She can let the child here and nobody won't do nothing against her. And it's hard to find them because some of them don't have identity cards.
So what happens to these children? Some of them stay hidden in hospital nurseries until they're toddlers and relatives or foster families can be found. Others go to state-run group homes and private orphanages. But 3 hours south of Brașov in the capital Bucharest, there's a new program underway that may provide a more lasting solution. 21-year-old Anna Maria is changing her 3-month-old son's diaper in a small dormitory room. Anna Maria and Stefan live in a nondescript building in a residential neighborhood on the edge of the city. Anna Maria and Stefan are part of a maternal shelter program. Its goal is to help mothers attach to their babies. The program is funded by the Romanian government in partnership with World Vision, which also sponsors this show. 10 mothers and babies live in this dorm. Similar homes are scattered across the country. Each of the mothers was considered at risk of abandoning her baby. Take Anna Maria. She was just 19 when she became pregnant. She says everyone told her not to keep the baby.
I was not married. I didn't have a house, a future, anything to offer him. Not even money for, anything, clothes or something, you know?
And no emotional support.
The father, the parents, the friends, they all kind of disappear in a fog, you know, after a while.
And when that happens, young Romanian mothers usually disappear in a fog, too. They detach from their newborns by refusing to hold them or even to look at them in the hospital. Now the government is trying to reverse a culture of abandonment. As soon as mothers give birth, nurses encourage them to hold and nurse their babies. Anna Maria responded just as they had hoped.
I think the most special event in a woman's life is when you stay there and they give your child for the first time to see him and to hold him in your arms. I think that is the most special event ever.
The hard work begins once the girls take their babies home. The maternal shelter supports them in this transition.
The program helps me in very many special ways. The organization helped me to keep my studies, to go on with my life. Finding a job, they will help me. They will help me in money for 6 months.
Now, with a little confidence under her belt and a healthy bond established with her son, Anna Maria's dreams are beginning to sound like most young mothers.
I want him to do all the things that I never had the chance to. Even if I'm poor, even if I don't have the situation he really deserves, because I think he deserves the world, I will try to give him the best. Wherever I will go, he will be with me, good or bad, no matter what. And I think it will be good for him because he has my love. Forever.
The World Vision Report's Christina Darden produced this report. Later in the show, a page from her reporter's notebook. Stay with us for that. While post-election violence in Kenya has captured the headlines over the last several weeks, kidnappings, shootings, and bombings in the Niger Delta have gone virtually unnoticed. That's because violence is common in this chaotic part of Nigeria. The Niger Delta is home to one of the richest oil fields in the world. Elizabeth Dickinson is a freelance journalist based in Nigeria's capital, Lagos. She's been reporting on the violence in the Niger Delta. She says the tension in the region is palpable.
In the city of Port Harcourt itself, which is where a lot of the violence has been focused lately, for the last few months, there's actually been a curfew on the city, which has put the city in a bit of chaos. So every evening, you see people running towards their houses to try to make the curfew before dark. As far as what it looks like, there's right now a very heavy military presence on the ground, and that is in response to the violence.
What is behind all of this violence?
Well, the first group, and the one that's older and actually even dates back to before independence, is a group that's arisen in response to the profound poverty of the region, which comes in contrast to the vast oil wealth that happens to be below the surface there. Well, beginning in, say, the 1990s, the environmental damage and the extent of poverty became overwhelming. And so you saw a whole group of youth and community leaders who organized around that cause. today, those militants have gotten a bit more forward in their action. And so these are the groups that you see attacking oil facilities. So that's one group. And those people are sort of protesting very real grievances about the poverty of on the ground. Now, on the other side of things, you have a whole group of militants who have learned that this is a very strong economic function, that they can really make a lot of money off of this militancy. A lot of these groups, these particularly criminal-type groups, have allied themselves with politicians, for example. The politicians might find it advantageous to pay the thugs to rig elections, to take care of political dissidents. And so these groups all of a sudden have an influx of money, an influx of political ties, and they're really wreaking havoc on the region.
There seems to be a real disconnect, and you mentioned the poverty on the ground that's angered so many of these people. Why is it that there's so much oil to be found and so much money coming out of these oil fields in Nigeria, and yet the communities around there are just stuck in abject poverty?
Well, you're exactly right. And one of the reasons it has a lot to do with the way that the revenue structure is organized. Most of the oil revenues that are coming out of the Delta area go first into the federal government's money. Now, their account is divided among Nigeria's states. Nigeria is a federation, so much like the United States, and the budgets are very localized. So the money comes into the local government in the states that are producing oil, but much of it gets caught up there. And this is a lot of what we hear about corruption, about poor implementation of policy. But the truth is, a lot of the money just gets stuck right there in the hands of the government.
Are the oil companies doing anything to ensure that these poor communities surrounding their oil fields are better taken care of?
Well, the answer is mixed to that. First of all, I should say most of the oil companies have a very comprehensive social development program. They devote a lot of money to building schools, providing electricity, and putting money back into these communities. That having been said, there's been a lot of controversy about how that money has been spent. Community leaders will tell you that a lot of the money goes to certain individuals within the community that are meant to sort of keep the community peaceful and keep them away from facilities, for example. You'll go into school buildings in some of the villages that are empty, don't have desks, don't have teachers. So yes, it's been built, but the question is it being used and is it useful to the community?
This region has historically been very dependent on fishing and agriculture. I'm wondering how oil production has affected these industries.
A lot of the oil production that has come into the region has had a detrimental effect on the environment. Communities complain it's very difficult to find fertile soil anymore. It's very difficult to use the groundwater because it's been contaminated by oil spills. The fish have been overfished, and there's not a lot of economic potential left in the land. So that really causes a huge problem for these communities, which are structurally farming communities, fishing communities.
Elizabeth, I'm wondering what the people in these villages told you when you visited. I mean, you met a lot of them. How is the average resident there coping with the violence and the loss of their traditional jobs?
People are definitely frustrated with the pace at which they're seeing development moving. Projects that are undertaken will take years to complete and maybe never finish. So there is frustration in that regard. There's also sadness about the loss of traditional culture. But you do see, in a lot of cases, a good deal of hope. There are a lot of community leaders who realize that oil can be a very productive thing for their community and can bring development. It's just a question of how to make that happen.
All right. Elizabeth Dickinson, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Dickinson is a freelance journalist based in Nigeria. We spoke to her over satellite phone. In many parts of the world, women and girls walk long distances to collect water. Often, the water they carry home is dirty, and it can cause disease. According to a 2006 United Nations report, diarrhea caused by contaminated water is the second largest cause of child mortality. Jessica Partnow has this installment of our series, A Day in the Life.
Dilo Town is a short stretch of thatched huts lining a dirt road in southern Ethiopia. About 32,000 people live in this community. It's 44 miles from the nearest paved road, 9 from the closest man-made well, and 2 days' drive from the capital city, Addis Ababa. We're close to the Kenyan border here, and not much else. By 6 a.m., Fadi Jilo is hard at work.
I wake up early in the morning and I light a fire to make some tea for breakfast.
Fadi is 30 years old and has 3 young children.
Then I clean my house, I have goats, and I take them to pasture. After I take the goats, I go to fetch water.
This is the height of Ethiopia's dry season. Water and pasture for livestock are scarce. Fadi is anxiously awaiting the rains, expected by the beginning of March. For now, with no water falling from the sky, Fadi must make the long walk to haul it from a spring. As I follow her toward the edge of Dilo Town in the pale morning sunlight, we're joined by several other women in colorful sari-like dresses. Each woman is carrying a jerry can, a 5.5-gallon plastic jug. The cans are a crucial commodity. A new one can cost half of a family's annual cash income. As we reach the end of the short dirt path leading out of town, we come to the rim of a deep crater. At the bottom, there's a former salt lake, brown mud crusted over with glistening white salt.
More than 100 women fetch water here every day. Even other women from the surrounding areas come to collect water here.
The spring is a natural pool tucked into the side of the crater. The water is brackish and shared with hundreds of sheep, goats, and cattle. Their waste contaminates the water supply, causing everything from amoebic dysentery and intestinal parasites to scabies and conjunctivitis. Many people here, especially young children and the elderly, suffer constantly from these ailments.
We get very sick from the water here. People have stomachache, diarrhea with blood, even death. About 20 people die here every year.
Boiling would help prevent waterborne illness, but no one here can afford the fuel. Each woman fills her jerry can at the edge of the pool, screwing the lid on over a tiny square of plastic cut from a plastic bag. The extra plastic bolsters the worn threads on the lip of the jar and keeps every drop of water inside. A full jerry can weighs 44 pounds. Fadi struggles to hoist her load up the steep bank of the shallow pool, a bank made steeper every day by dropping water levels. She makes a cushion out of a bright green shawl, which she ties onto the small of her back. The bottom of the jerry can rests on this padding, and she binds the full can to herself with rope made from animal sinews. Imagine strapping 10 2-liter bottles of soda to your back and walking straight uphill in flimsy plastic sandals.
We're walking up a very steep, rocky slope. All of them, except for the 11-year-old and the 13-year-old, have 20 liters of water on their back. For me, carrying 1.5 liters is exhausting.
Fadi and the other women make this trek 3 times a day. Their walk is only 1.5-hour round trip, shorter than in some areas, but it's long enough for the women to get hurt.
People break their bones, they dislocate their joints, and the problem is worse when we go to fetch water when it is dark. One woman fell down while she was pregnant and she lost the baby.
There is hope for water in Dilo Town. The government says it plans to start work on bringing piped water to Dilo next year, but Fadi doubts that will happen.
We have applied so many times for help, for them to provide us with a water system, but nobody responds to us. They have promised us so many times, but they haven't done anything.
Fadi's life would change dramatically with regular access to safe water. Her daughters would be able to go to school every day, something they can't do now since school shuts down when there's no water. And Fadi would be able to spend more time tending livestock and earning money for her family. Till then, she waits for the three-month-long rainy season, when her water walks will stop for a while. Or so she hopes. A recent UN report says global warming is intensifying droughts in Ethiopia. And Fadi says that lately the rains in Dilo have only been lasting half as long as they used to. For the World Vision Report, I'm Jessica Partnow.
Funding for this segment was provided by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Only a few generations ago in South Korea, blind people were considered to be bad luck. People actually threw salt at them to ward off evil spirits. Although that's not the case anymore, the blind in South Korea have few options when it comes to earning a living. Jason Strother reports from Seoul.
Yang Chu-suk's long white cane scrapes across the sidewalk as he walks to his next appointment. He's been a licensed massage therapist ever since he graduated from a school for the blind 35 years ago. He says the blind have a unique ability for massaging.
눈이 잘 안 보이게 되면 정신 집중을 하는데.
When you can't see, you can concentrate better. And that's why we perform massages very well.
His client greets Yang, who's dressed sharply in suit and tie, and lets him into the apartment. Like Yang, thousands of South Korea's blind and visually impaired practice massage. In fact, since 1913, only the blind have been legally permitted to work as masseurs. Today in Korea, there still aren't many job alternatives for the blind. Many live a life of isolation and poverty. It's not uncommon to see blind people begging on the subway. Yang says without massage training, he doesn't know what would have happened to him.
When I graduated from high school in 1972, the economic situation in Korea was really bad. My life would have been very difficult.
The nation's Supreme Court knocked down the law that gives blind Koreans the exclusive right to work as massage therapists, opening the industry to anyone. For 3 months, several thousand blind masseuses and their supporters held daily protests. Two demonstrators even committed suicide in public to show their anger. Eventually, the court overturned its earlier ruling. The blind were given back their exclusive privilege to practice massage, although illegal operations, that often include prostitution, continue to cut into their business. Kim Ho-sik teaches at the Seoul National School for the Blind, which offers massage training. He says across the country, there are many more blind people than spots and training programs.
There are around 200,000 blind people here, and only 1 or 2,000 can actually get training and massage. For the rest, there really aren't many other opportunities.
He says the school has tried other training programs, such as language translation and telemarketing. Kim says the blind school even started a college prep program, which gives students a diploma equivalent to a mainstream high school. But there just aren't enough resources or student interest to make these efforts successful. Kim says many students feel their only guarantee against joblessness is a career as a masseuse. He believes the blind would feel more comfortable about going into different fields if the sighted world knew more about them.
There is a lack of understanding about the blind in Korea. Sighted people don't know the situation of disabled people. If there was more integration, if more blind went to normal high schools and not blind schools, then we could overcome these difficulties.
Until social attitudes toward the blind improve, Kim says that most of Korea's visually impaired will have very few options to earn a living. For the World Vision Report, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul, South Korea.
As we heard earlier in the show, the abandonment of children is a huge problem in Romania. But what about that other vulnerable section of the population, the elderly? The World Vision Report's Christina Darden met some older Romanians and filed this reporter's notebook. I'd just finished poking my head into a particularly beautiful Orthodox cathedral that flanks the square. As I turned to go, I saw an old woman standing at the side of the entrance, hands outstretched. She was one of many poverty-stricken Romanians that I had seen in my few days here. What stood out was that the majority of them were elderly, selling odds and ends on the side of the street, or, like her, simply begging. She looked modestly at the ground as person after person passed her by, a tattered shawl draped across her shoulders. She had a roughly cropped head of fading brown hair mixed with white. It was so thin I could see her scalp. I reached into my pocket for a few pieces of change, but when our hands connected for some unknown reason, I stopped. I think it surprised her as much as it did me. That's when she looked up. Her eyes were gray and clouded. They seemed filled with sadness and an absolute weariness. My translator had stepped away for a while, so there was no way I could communicate with her. And even if I could, I wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to say. So, without thinking too much about it, I gently placed my hand on her left shoulder and smiled. Then I turned to walk away. Before my arm was back by my side, she began to speak to me. First, it was a few words, almost in a whisper. Then they came pouring out. I felt panicked for a moment. I could tell whatever she was telling me was important, but I didn't want her to feel foolish when she realized I couldn't understand. Then she began to cry. Hesitantly, I moved to comfort her, remembering that most Romanians are reserved about displays of emotion. But before my arms could complete the embrace, I felt her weight fall on my shoulders, and she began to sob. By now, other beggars from the streets, older women mainly, had begun to gather around us. They stared in silence. I looked at a grandmotherly woman in the crowd, my eyes pleading for some direction as Romanian words continued to flow beside me. She gave me a gentle smile and simply nodded her head in the direction of this woman now in my arms, bidding me to stay. I felt helpless and wondered what heartbreaking tale this woman was telling me. Did she have no family? Was she sick with some illness she couldn't afford to treat? Or was it simply the exhaustion of existing in a world where you seemed invisible? I spoke to her in words she didn't know. She did the same to me. But my anxiety about bridging the language gap began to ease, and then I realized words didn't matter. That was Christina Darden, producer for the World Vision Report. And that brings us to the end of our show this week. You can hear the program anytime at our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can also sign up for a podcast if you'd like to take us with you. Our radio team includes Doug Boyles, Mark Bandy, Christina Darden, Lita Hartman, and I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.